We need Mr. Briggs. Okay, so I had a few questions. It's on the Four Waters.
So,
okay.
Excuse me, are we moving on to the Four Waters now, or are we going to have board questions on both for staff?
Oh, it's board questions on both.
Okay.
Yeah, but I just, my questions right now are to Four Waters, and it's on page 4 of 8 of the order itself. In paragraph 14, you mentioned that CDF considered the recommendations made on the NTMP by the review team?
Correct.
Before determining that the NTMP conformed? Did they adopt the recommendations? What happened?
The CDF process? You know what? I don't feel comfortable to speak to that specifically. I might have to defer again. Bill, do you feel comfortable explaining that process? I don't know how that works.
I mean, specifically with this particular one, the recommendations that were made by the team to CDF, what did they do with those recommendations? Did they make changes?
I don't know. I wasn't involved with that in 2001 when they adopted it.
Ah, okay.
Did you want some clarification on that?
Yes.
So that process is the review team process,
right,
where all of the agencies sit down, Fish and Game, California Geologic Society, CDF, water quality, city, county, all those people sit down, and it's basically a giant negotiation as to what's reasonable and what's not, what the RPF feels is a reasonable recommendation. I mean, anybody can recommend anything.
Right.
You know, they could say, well, we recommend that you don't manage half your property, but that's not a reasonable recommendation generally, right? Just to say, hey, we don't want you managing the west side of your property or something like that could be a recommendation, but it's not necessarily a reasonable recommendation. So it ends up being a negotiation between all the agencies considering all the factors, and then there's a decision made on it. So, but if you had a specific recommendation, I could tell you whether or not that recommendation was adopted, but you'd have to go through all the PHI reports, the pre-harvest inspection reports of each agency, see what the recommendation was and see whether it was accepted or modified. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense. It just doesn't give us at this point in time.
You'd have to spend 10 or 12 hours going through the record to really find the answer to that.
Okay.
If this provides you any comfort, but at the time when the application was submitted, and you'll see that the landowner will discuss that it was a very extended period of time between the time they received the application and received a formal response. The reason for that being is that since this plan was adopted in 2001, I had not been involved with the type of situation that you're discussing. So what I do is I retrieve the file. I read all of the recommendations, all of the pre-harvest inspections, that reports that were submitted as part of the file, and the plan itself. And I didn't find, this is what I can say, I don't have a list of what recommendations didn't make it into the plan, but as I read through the pre-harvest inspections, I didn't see anything in there that I found alarming that wasn't in the plan. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, that does.
So that's the... as much as I can offer you as far as that question goes, because I understand what you're getting at.
Well, I guess in the future, I would like to know specifically whether there were any recommendations that I guess were not adopted by CDF that you felt maybe should have been or, were necessary. So there's just some notation in here within a paragraph like that.
Okay, I can absolutely include that.
And I guess if you felt that there was something necessary, you would incorporate it anyway.
Correct. Yes, that's another catch for that.
Right. Okay.
And yes. So at this time, I can tell you, based on my review of the file, there's nothing that I felt got dropped off.
But just to be clear, the pre-harvest inspection must have occurred in 2001.
Right.
Correct.
Which
is
why you weren't part of it.
Correct.
Because normally you try to be present on all pre-harvest inspections.
Yes.
I know you don't. It sounds like you can't make it to all of them, But as a matter of principle, especially with a Tier 4, you want to be there, and that explains why you weren't there, because you weren't staffing this program at the time.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Do MRPs terminate when the permit terminates?
No.
So
they need to be rescinded by the executive officer, I believe.
Well, these are five-year permits.
Right.
So at the end of 5 years. See, I notice here, and this is the individual conditional waiver for Four Waters. You have a comment here, monitoring shall continue until this MRP is rescinded.
Correct.
Which leads me to think it continues on indefinitely.
Correct.
Or would terminate when the 5 years is up.
It doesn't automatically terminate when the 5 years are up.
Okay.
So the way I would explain it is we've laid out a monitoring plan for the first 5 years, and at the end of 5 years, it's the requirement of the discharger to contact us and say that my end of 5 years is coming, I need you to come out and do an inspection. And then at that time I say, okay, I'll recommend that it get rescinded, or I believe that it's appropriate that we extend your monitoring plan, and at that time I would add year six and beyond. Mm. So, and we wouldn't entertain rescinding it prior to 5 years.
Okay.
So,
well, that would be a kind of a critical point for staff at that last possible inspection juncture.
Yes.
To make sure that all of the erosion control devices are functioning properly and that things are kind of tied down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. And then this is just kind of a general concern I have. And is Lisa here, or did she take off? Is anyone else from the TMDL staff here?
No.
Yeah, if you could, and then I'll defer to any other board members that have questions right now. Mr. Shellcross.
Maybe you could clarify this for me a little bit. On the NTMP, is it non-industrial or
Yes, non-industrial.
Yeah. And that one's that doesn't have an expiration date on it, right?
No.
Okay, so the folks can go in over a period of years and I guess my question is, if our permit is for 5 years, what happens after that? Do they have to come back for another permit every time they go in?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what's triggering this one now, even though it was adopted in 2001. It's 2007.
Oh, they're re-entering?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I don't know that they entered in the first place, but
okay.
Whenever they decide to enter, they have to contact us.
They have to come back.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. And it's not a permit, it's a waiver, I know. But, yeah.
Okay. Lisa, kind of re-educate me a little bit on how we're doing with our TMDL in this area.
Okay.
And with, you know, the road situations, private roads, county roads. There were some comments in some of the letters that we had for these two items about, you know, this is timber is a component of the overall sedimentation loading. So where are we in terms of implementation of our San Lorenzo TMDL?
I'm Lisa McCann, and I'd like to step over there and grab my implementation status report that's on the floor, and then I'm going to answer your question.
Okay, good.
As far as roads go, the primary implementation action is the Santa Cruz County RCD's Rural Roads Maintenance Program and Roads Restoration or Stabilization Program. And they had a they completed one phase of a first project, grant-funded project, where they developed a maintenance guidebook that was then distributed to landowners, as well as did a lot of outreach and did some physical restoration projects. They have a second phase that is now just initiated in progress. What I don't have for you is the information on which areas, where the projects were exactly, and where they're targeting in their next phase. So they have a prioritization approach to where they're, geographically, where they're dealing with the private roads.
So right now they're in public outreach and doing demonstrations. Mm-hmm. Do they have a time frame for getting into requiring?
Well, they don't have authority to require. We would have to require private landowners to do something to their private roads.
Okay. This is kind of like a regulatory ping pong ball. We've heard that it was our authority. No, it was the county's authority, back and forth. When we had that timber workshop, we had the county come out and tell us that it was going to get serious about roads.
Mm-hmm. Let me clarify something. There's also an action in the TMDL implementation plan for public roads. So the county owned and operated roads.
No, yeah, but I'm referring to public, private.
To private roads.
Private roads.
Right.
And so are you saying that as part of the TMDL program, we could require some different management and operations and maintenance of private roads?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's do that.
Well, what is staff's time frame for doing that?
We don't have an established time frame. We've just completed this third year implementation evaluation and assessed where things are at and are in the process of determining next steps. So if the outcome of that is that we assess that they've discovered that there are lots of private roads that are not being addressed, for example, or problem areas that are more of a problem than we thought or still a problem, that would be an appropriate response. But we haven't been able to evaluate it at that level.
Are you expecting that level of detail, and if so, about when?
One of the difficulties in committing to that level of detail is that we don't have the monitoring data. So we don't have new information about how what we've learned about the implementation actions relates to the locations and extent of the problem.
Okay.
We've just initiated monitoring.
But if you take a kind of BMP mm-hmm. sort of approach, mm-hmm. You could look at private roads and you could probably, some of them look like hell, a lot of them look like hell, and that would those would be good candidates for more vigorous outreach, to put it euphemistically.
Yeah.
So is there some way to get a priority ranking of what the most basket case private roads are in the county, and then we can try to go after those more vigorously? It's been years that we've been wanting to do
yeah.
that.
Can I just interrupt? I think we're getting a little far afield of the item that's before the
okay.
board, and I think this may
yeah.
be more appropriate for an
right,
informational item maybe at the next meeting.
Yeah, but it is. But it's in this. It's in on this topic that this item comes up. We don't ever get it. We get it tangentially when we talk about TMDL, but
yeah.
we don't get it when we talk about this. Our only opportunity to talk about the nature of roads in forested areas of Santa Cruz County is when there's a timber
yeah.
harvest
yeah.
Plan before us.
But we do have planned a February, with the change in the schedule, maybe March, but a focused item that does talk about the relationship between sediment sources specifically in response to, I think, your last board meeting discussion on this item. So
okay.
I appreciate what you're saying,
right.
but we are going to respond to that. So.
Okay, I'll shut up.
When is that going to be?
The next North meeting.
Next North meeting,
okay.
yeah.
You know, sure, we'll continue this at another time, but I'm kind of frustrated with the whole process, just in how much time it takes. I know it's very complex, but time is going by, and it seems like we should have these milestones out there.
Are you talking generally? Or are you talking about this?
These TMDLs, because these are related.
Oh, TMDLs.
This
okay.
is the kind of thing where we have a problem, and the stormwater permit's supposed to catch
right.
that item.
I wasn't sure whether you were talking about TMDLs or forest.
No,
permits.
No, the TMDLs,
okay.
and we're talking about the impacts here are erosion, sedimentation, and a TMDL is a tangential regulatory tool to try to achieve the same or similar results as we're trying to do with these individual permits. So they're not exclusive of one another. They overlap. And so, you know, I just want staff to know that the board isn't forgetting about this, even though, because it doesn't come up all the time.
I'd like to just remind you of one more thing about the San Lorenzo River sediment TMDL. It's different than the more recent sediment in other TMDLs you've seen, where we have explicitly established basin plan prohibitions and program strategies for staff to identify the dischargers and use our regulatory tools in a specified time frame. It was written with acknowledging existing and many voluntary actions. So in order to really make that real through the TMDL, or more importantly through our programs, we really have to reevaluate what the entire program for that watershed is and look at it with our, you know, applying our regulatory tools with the new state of the information and hopefully advanced level of management implementation through grant giving and through the other coordinated efforts that have occurred in the watershed.
Okay. So at our next northern meeting, you'll be able to
give us a
status report also with what the county is doing with the public roads.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Before she leaves, are you looking at the whole region or just Santa Cruz County?
In this context, we're looking at Santa Cruz, not even Santa Cruz, all of Santa Cruz County. We're looking at San Lorenzo River watershed and sediment loading and sources of sediment loading to San Lorenzo River watershed rivers and tributaries.
Because we have the TMDL there, and that's the tool.
Well, I understand, but we have other TMDLs, and I'm wondering if, and I know this is getting far-fetched, but I just wanted a quick answer.
Yeah.
Are we going to do this
in general, we are looking at the relativeness of the different TMDLs and the multiple watersheds and program transferring the programs that we're establishing and improving in the latest watershed and applying it back to the others, but that's even farther beyond what we're talking about right now with this item.
Then. Work cut out for you.
So.
Yeah, you need more to do, Lisa.
Okay, bring it on.
That's the question. Where are we going to get the staff to do all that?
Well, we've got a card for you. We're not voting on anything at this point. We're going to have public comment next. So,
there were some public comments that the waivers didn't comply with the TMDLs. There's two separate TMDLs. One applies to each, and I checked those, and the waivers do comply with the implementation plans for those TMDLs, which are basically they need to have waivers with requirements in them. There's load allocations of how much sediment can be discharged in each sub-watershed, but it's not a source-by-source allocation of sediment discharges. It's for the entire watershed, so unless either of these plans is going to be discharging so much sediment that they exceed the load for the entire watershed, they're not in violation.
Okay, to be continued. Any other board questions at this point of staff before we go to our cards? Okay. Mr. Brick, shall we do that?
Sure.
Do we want to hear the foresters' presentation first or the cards first?
Sure. Well, they're on the cards.
Ma'am, are you indicating that you can't hear us in the back?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Well, we had a little volume problem here a minute ago.
Okay. Now, we got a request, right, Julia, for 10 minutes from each of the foresters.
Correct.
So why don't we start with the forester Four Waters.
Okay.
And that's Mr. Vaughn. Okay.
Chairman Young, members of the board, Bill Vaughn, registered forester, working with Stephen Dowsman for the Four Waters NTMP. As you'll see, I'm going to briefly go through these presentation contents, but I think more importantly, I'll kind of get to each of the specifics of those. So I'm just going to move forward. Here's the Four Waters. You've seen all the maps. Actually, I don't really need to go over much in this regard. This is the monitoring map, which is going to receive some minor modifications. I don't know where the pointer is, but was switching around one of those T5, which is in the southwest corner of the plan area.
Incidentally, Mr. Vaughn, a clearer map would be great. That was really very hard to read.
Yeah, I understand.
It's like a map within a map, or you know, maybe subsections of it. Just it's very difficult to read
without having it in front of you.
And it's not. We don't get it in color either.
Right.
So, something nicer would be great.
Okay, no problem. I guess the point is that this little monitoring point was moved over to include above and below that slide feature right there, which is going to give us some meaningful data. Not really the point of this, but the maintenance history on this, Mr. Dowsman purchased the property in 1995 and has continued to upgrade and rock various portions voluntarily. Since purchasing the property, they go out every winter, and you'll hear from the Dowsmans here later, they're going to speak. In 2000, they applied for the NTMP, and which just furthered their commitment to the land, have had EQIP and CFIP projects to allow thinning and maintenance of the sprouts without any commercial management since they actually had the plan approved in 2000. So, which is, they've just delayed doing it for and have continued to make improvements out of pocket since then. As part of the NTMP, there was a requirement for bioremediation in 2001, and they've done that for 5 years straight, including photo monitoring. It's available for your review if you'd like to take a look at the file. And they've continued to do that with great success. And I think the next, as we go through these photos, you'll get some pictures of before and after the remediation efforts. The Belma Creek Road, which is the road that parallels a portion of the property there, and on out to Eagle Tree, which is then the paved road, which is the primary access road off of Ziani, is entirely rocked for its entire length in there, which is goes above and beyond what's required under the forest practice rules, not to mention the fact that those aren't even really within the operating area, and that they've, again, it highlights their commitment to good management. Contrary to what was mentioned about the interbridge slide area, which was that slide feature that Julia had mentioned, there is in fact rock on it. It's just the ash component in there is pretty slimy, and it gets transported from that near creek location when it's dried out a little bit, and they actually transport it and put it onto a flat and stabilize it above and out of the watercourse and lake protection zone. The roads west of X5, which is a bridge crossing just below that that slide area, is entirely rocked. And this is just to mention the upgrades that they've voluntarily done, independent of any waiver or official review. It has gone through the planning and review process. Obviously, all the participants in the PHI, the county, the city, water quality people, fish and game. I don't think water quality was on this particular review, but it's not to say that fish and game, the county, the city, and all those people weren't looking at the various components of it. And I think the key element, and some of the letters indicated that it was perhaps that they missed the fact that there was a domestic supply downstream of that in Loch Lomond Reservoir. And the fact is, everybody knew Loch Lomond was there. It was reviewed knowing that was there and was mitigated to the extent that they felt it was necessary to control sediment and runoff. Everybody commented on the letter and on the original proposal, and that was done with full knowledge that there was a domestic supply, and that's it was included in the plan. I think that one of the points that was already made was that each notice of timber operations, which is what you file and what's before you today, requires a separate waiver. So 15 years from now, you're going to require a separate waiver, at which time you can evaluate the effectiveness of the current monitoring and reporting program. The T&I rules weren't in effect when this plan was originally submitted in 2000, but due to some voluntary efforts, really, on the part of the landowner, we applied the same canopy protection measures for the Class 1 watercourses, which is 85% of the canopy shall be retained within 75 feet of the watercourse, and then after that, it's a slightly lesser percentage. But the fact is, those T&I rule, the intent of those rules were applied in addition to the large tree retention requirements, which are 8 per 330 feet along either side of the Class 1 watercourse. Courses, which is exactly the same as the T&I rules. All the roads are currently rocked within the WLPZs, which is, again, a voluntary effort, but complies with the T&I rules. The monitoring required under the current MRP goes above and beyond what the T&I rules require. And there were several citations in a number of letters that I read against the plan that mentioned that it wasn't that the T&I rules were not applied to this plan, when in fact, if you read closely through the plan, you'll notice that the intent of those rules was accepted as part of a voluntary effort to protect water quality. I think we clarified the limited what winter operations were relative to extended fall operations. It's really just a one-month extension from October 15th to November 15th, and even during that period, there's extensive limitations on what you can do. The winter operations map, which is right there. shows you that the winter operating area is actually limited entirely to this ridgetop, very gentle slopes up on this ridgetop area, nothing down in near the water courses in through here or up on the west side of the property. It's a very limited area, and again, very limited to the extent of work that can be done given the amount of rainfall that during the winter period. I got to go back. So that's, and then again, just the rock road. So next slide, cross-felling, there was a mention of that. I'm not really going to get into it other than to say all the timber within this year's sale has been marked, and there aren't any cross-felled trees. That's just a very limited instance where a tree might be marked where it's more effective and will protect water quality better than the standard rule, which requires falling it up the slope. Again, just to note that we can revisit this, and if next time the waiver comes up and somebody asks me whether there's any cross-felled trees, I'll tell them because it'll probably be marked, and I'll let you know whether there's cross-felled trees, and we can discuss it at that point.
Mr. Vaughn, could you define cross-felled again?
Oh, cross-felling is say there was a channel here, a tree that's very near the channel would be felled this direction, albeit across the water course would be in a preferable location than getting it up here, which might cause it to kick back down into the creek. So it's just a judgment situation as to where you could allow in certain situations to actually cross the creek without contacting the channel, and just makes it, and it's a judgment call. And then, like I say, of all the trees that we marked out there wasn't one in this time that we cross-felled. It just allows some flexibility in management. And the purpose, and that's really what the purpose of cross-felling is a site-specific professional judgment by the forester that allows protection of the resource. The interbridge slide area, which I think was probably the biggest bone of contention with this whole thing, is before the NTMP was even approved, the landowner was already applying mitigation measures to that site. It then received additional comment, and mainly from the County of Santa Cruz, Matt Balzakowski, who required that there be a bioremediation fix on that, which we have been implementing for the last 5 years and reporting annually on with photo documentation. The fact of the matter is there's an in-place volcanic ash deposit there that the creeks run through, the road runs through, everything in that canyon is running through this ash deposit, and it's eroding naturally anyway. What you're seeing is just an exposed portion of it that we've now mitigated. And so we'll go on to you'll get to see some photo history. There's a catch basin right below. Somebody had mentioned, well, where's that water going? As you saw it coming down the road, there's actually a catch basin right below that we've maintained and enlarged, and when it needs to be cleaned out, it's cleaned out to avoid. And you'll see in the pictures of the creek where the creek that actually has the road and ash deposit slide is much cleaner than the other creek that's coming in from the north, which has some development associated with it. I'm just going to go right to the photos. That's in 2001. That was the beginning of the bioremediation work right there. It's nearing completion. That you can see that there's jute that's seeded. There's willow wattles. There's a number of seeding options that have been in place already there. The next photo is in December when we've had some rains. You can notice that these tarps were applied to make sure that whatever soil was being built up on top of this ash deposit was protected so that it could actually start getting some deep-rooted species into that to try and stabilize it. And then the third photo is from a different location. It's very similar to what Chris Berry included in his city report, but that is actually the before we were taking a picture that way. This gives you a little broader view of it, but you can see that Equisetum, some of the maples are coming in. You're actually seeing a lot of regrowth on this slide area, and the bioremediation measures were very effective. And we'll continue to monitor another 5 years under the waiver because it's one of the photo points that's included in our waiver.
Mr. Vaughn, yeah. Just let you know you got about a minute and a quarter left.
Okay, I'll just cruise through that then. I think the city access road issue was primarily a civil issue anyway. I think Julia did a good job of covering the turbidity sampling points. I think the one thing is this next slide. This is a right above the property on the Peterson Creek fork, and this is an example of what you guys were talking about in terms of the TMDL and what other things are going on in the watershed. This is an old road that comes across, and people have used it as a trespass dirt bike traffic going right through the creek, and you're going to see in our photos, in our turbidity sampling, what this generates downstream. You're going to get a picture of that in your turbidity samples, and you know that's up to you guys to figure out how you can regulate regulate unregulated activities pretty much, or try and address unregulated activities. You know, we as foresters are supporting more of a comprehensive watershed-wide study that truly aims at trying to get scientific data. We'd love to work with you to try and get all the stakeholders in the watershed to get together and consider unregulated and regulated activities in the greater context, because I think that's the only time you're actually going to get answers to any of this. But and I think the waiver process is, you know, it's a time-consuming process. It's been 180 days. I think the landowners going to attest to some of that. And I think what's become apparent in the last several years, having dealt with it for the further six years, is that a lot of the people that are against the waiver, you know, trying to speak out against the waiver, are using this as a tool, really, as an environmental activist tool to try and circumvent kind of the NTMP and the review process and get again to it here in the waiver format. And it's you know, our track record has been excellent, and we appreciate your time today and hope that you approve our waiver. Thanks.
Okay. Any questions from Mr. Vaughn from the board? Okay.
He was going to show us that catch basin. I was interested in.
Do you have a picture of it?
I can send you a picture of it. I do have a picture of the catch basin.
Yeah, you related that you had a photograph of it.
Yeah, we do have a picture of it. I can email it to you. I had 24 photos, so I just kind of chose some that. It's a brief presentation, so thanks. Any questions?
Thank you. Doesn't look like it. Okay, not now at least. Okay. Who's on first base? Mr. Briggs, right here. Mr. Dousman?
Well, I suppose so as far as continuity goes.
Yeah, he's the landowner.
Right.
And then we'll start with these.
I'm not sure who our second forester is.
Are there two?
Do you want to discuss the drinking goats right now, or do you want to wait?
No, for continuity, I think we'll go here with the landowner.
Michael Duffy's the forester for the Eureka Gulch.
Okay. All right.
But let's stick with this property.
Right.
Is this
is the applicant, Mr. Shellcross. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Briggs, members of the board, good morning. In our initial exploration of Four Waters, one day Linda and I were walking down that same road you've seen a dozen pictures of, and when we got to the Newell Creek Bridge, I looked down and I said, I'm going to go down and check the creek. And so I hiked down and I sat on a rock and I listened to the water, and in a moment Linda beckoned me up, and I went up and curiously said, "What's the rush?" She looked at me and said, "Well, how long do you think you were down there?" And I said, 3 or 4 minutes. She says, "I've been out hiking for 45 minutes. You know, for the first time in your life, you've experienced meditation." Well, since then, we've found a lot of other special places. And the message I want to get to you is, we're not going to harm our home. You may have noticed in staff's report, it commented that the trees are all marked. Also that they're marked at less than required. We could have taken more. I would hate to think that the excess costs that this type of process amounts to might lead us to have to send out more truckloads than we want. I will say that Linda and I actually went out and unmarked a few trees. My forester doesn't know that, but that's all part of our concern for our home. And the message is simply, trust us. We've got a good record, and we'll show you that we can do it right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Okay, so were we going to do then Eureka Gulch concurrently and then just vote separately? Is that okay? All right, so now the forester for Eureka Gulch, correct?
Well, good morning still. My name is Michael Duffy. I'm a forester for Redwood Empire, and I'm the project RPF. I appreciate the opportunity to address the board and provide any additional information that may be of assistance to the individual waiver decision. We have worked cooperatively with the Water Quality Control Board staff throughout the process and agree with the individual waiver that they have designed. We are asking that the board approve the waiver as proposed by staff. The Eureka Gulch area was originally clear-cut around 1900 using steam donkeys. Partial second-growth harvests occurred 50 and 38 years ago using ground-based operations. These operations constructed a network of truck roads and skid trails throughout the project area. 12 years ago, the first harvest under Redwood Empire introduced cable yarding operations to the gulch. Such cable operations allowed timber harvesting to access timber on steep slopes without disturbing soil with heavy equipment. The current project is the Eureka Gulch 1THP, consisting of 161 acres of selective timber harvesting. The plan shall utilize the existing infrastructure through ground-based and cable yarding operations. No new roads are proposed for construction. A 160-foot segment of road is proposed for temporary reconstruction and subsequent abandonment. We were surprised that this particular project reached a Tier 4. The tiering worksheet works out it, and it's correct, apparently. And this occurred for a number of reasons. The drainage density index is a high rating. The lengths of the water courses associated with the THP are a significant cause of the Tier 4. There's 2,700 feet of Class 1, 6,180 feet of Class 2, and 2,430 feet of Class 3 water course. Such water course lengths are outside of the control of the landowner. However, operations have been designed to minimize potential impacts to all water courses in the vicinity of the project. This project proposes to harvest 21 trees spread across 9.7 acres of Class 1 wilpis, or approximately 2 trees per acre. No trees are marked for harvest within 75 feet of a Class 1 watercourse. There is 800 feet of existing truck road, including an existing landing and 2 bridge crossings within the Class 1 wilpis. The road and landing are surfaced with rock. There is also 30 feet of existing skid trail within the wilpis that is proposed for skidding of logs. These locations and their minimization measures have been discussed at length within the THP. Within the Class 2, the project proposes to harvest approximately 12 trees per acre. No roads, landings, or skid trails are proposed for use. The cumulative effects ratio is also high. Approximately 33% of the 6,968 acres of the Coralitas Creek Planning Watershed has been harvested in the last 15 years. This counts the project area twice. Watershed-wide harvest rates are also outside of the control of the landowner. For the third category, the soil disturbance index is rated a medium. The length of skid trails and roads within the projects was above the average values for the plans within the southern sub-district since the inception of the general waiver. Maintaining and functioning an open road system is an important element of protecting and managing a forested landscape. The majority of the 3.5-mile existing road system associated with this project is properly functioning and does not pose a threat to water quality. There are only 4 existing watercourse crossings within the THP. Approximately 1,000, or 5%, of the road system is located within watercourse protection zones. There is no new road or crossing proposed with this project. A 160-foot road reconstruction will place a temporary road over an unstable feature. This road segment was constructed during the 1995 timber harvest, consisting of widening an existing skid trail and landing. This segment failed during the heavy rains during the 1996 and 1997 winter. In the reports, it was attributed to excessive drainage from a swale. The reconstructed road will be abandoned after one season of use, and all associated fills shall be excavated. This includes the fills along landing L21 that are currently perched above the feature. There are 3 cutbank failures that will also be removed from the road surface in other locations on the road. Appropriate minimization measures outlined in Section 2 of the Timber Harvest Plan will stabilize failed materials and remove any potential for delivery into watercourses. As for skid trails, there are 3.8 miles of existing trails and 120 feet of proposed trails associated with this plan. These trails are properly functioning and do not pose a threat to water quality. Approximately 60 feet, or 0.3%, of existing trails are located within watercourse protection zones. No skid trails or watercourse crossings are proposed. There's additional issues such as garbage. There's isolated depositions of debris within the THP area stemming from illegal camping that occurred within the last few years. Redwood Empire personnel began removing much of this debris concurrent with THP preparation. As land managers, it's our intent to remove as much debris as feasible from all Redwood Empire lands. Specific language has been installed into the waiver requiring this removal, and we concur with it. In other issues, there is a domestic water source downstream in Corlitas Creek for the city of Watsonville on the PHI. And the inspection, two members of the city of Watsonville were there to represent the city. They expressed no concerns with our project in regards to their domestic water intake. I would like to just speak for a second about the water quality staff's participation within the review process. On March 7th, representatives from the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board staff, including other agencies, inspected the area. Julia Dyer and Elaine Saul attended the PHI for Water Quality Control Board. Basically, their recommendations were incorporated into both CDF and CGS PHI reports. I won't get into too much further detail in regarding to that, but despite the tier four status for this project, the potential for impacts to water quality from harvest activities are minimal. I ask that you approve the individual waiver as written by the staff. I would be happy to address any additional questions or concerns regarding the project. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any board questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And do we have the landowner?
No, I'm representing the landowner.
We don't. Okay. All right. Then we have David Van Lennep, Eric Moore, Kevin Collins, and Jody Fratiani in that order.
Are we addressing both items?
Yes. So you'll have, well, then you'd get 6 minutes. Okay. Everyone is addressing both items, so I think that's fair. Okay. Mr. Van Lennep.
Good morning, members of the board. David Van Lennep, registered professional forester for Redwood Empire. I'll keep my comments brief. I wanted to thank the board for the opportunity to come up and have some extra time to explain about the project, given that this was a Tier 4, one of the first that this board's had to contend with, not unlike the previous process where each of the THPs was on an individual waiver basis. As Mike pointed out in his discussion, two of the three qualities that attributed us or pushed us into the Tier 4 were outside the control of the landowner. Those were length and classification of water course adjacent to the project and what others were doing in the greater watershed. So it wasn't as if there was something specific we were proposing that kicked us into one high or extremely high category of those, and I just wanted to kind of clarify that the project was designed to minimize all concerns of water quality and wildlife as the plans usually are.
And which project are you referring to?
Both? Oh, I'm sorry, this is Eureka Gulch. Okay. I'm sorry. And my comments will pertain mostly to that. In terms of the road abandonment, that was an area that we had concerns about. We had a private consulting engineering geologist look at it separately and give us a geology report regarding and the mitigation and the fix, or not the fix, but the treatment we're going to do on that particular area to get to the other side, do our harvesting, and then pull that length of road back. Were reviewed by him, approved by him, and also by California Geologic Survey as the geologic consultant for Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. So it has had double geologic oversight on that area. The project area has a considerable amount of road density, and it's worth noting that although there's only 161 acres under plan right now with this particular project, that road services other parcels, other areas of the property, and is also a part of a larger 400-acre parcel. So it's not as if that road is specific. Those densities are not specific to that 160 acres. The road does go other places and has been used with other harvests in the past. The trespass and debris that made it into the waiver as a condition to remove, we've had issues with people dumping garbage alongside the roads on the upper portion of the property, illegal activities inside the property, agricultural kinds of activities, and those individuals were not obligated to clean up after themselves and unfortunately left us with that task. We cleaned up as much of that material as we could reasonably before the pre-harvest inspection and actually in years prior to that with the help of Sheriff's Department and National Guard with the use of helicopters. Some of the debris loading was so remote and so concentrated that we needed to fly that material out with the help of National Guard. And we will continue to remove that material as we find it, and we chose to deal with the material that Julia saw in the pre-harvest inspection when we were able to get closer with equipment, because there was a considerable amount of it that we had put into the tent that they had left, and it was too big to carry out by hand. So we're going to wait till somebody is there with a loader or a larger piece of equipment. We can take it to the dump and dispose of it properly. Quickly on the TMDLs and RCDs, I know of a couple of projects in Santa Cruz and San Mateo County where RCD has looked at a road segment, possibly a high-priority road segment that needed some remediation and upgrading. One of those is in the Kings Creek area. County did a bunch of work on their section of the Kings Creek Road, and also that extended into the private section of Kings Creek Road. And I'm not sure what the cost share was. I'm not sure where that money was funded, but I do know that some projects are being looked at. I'm also familiar with one in San Mateo County that's being administered by RCD that has fish and game funding, similar kinds of issues to disconnect the road from the water courses. And those are roads that I'm familiar with because we use them. They're not under our control. They're residential access roads. Dr. Press may be familiar with the Kings Creek area, but there's considerable amount of semi-residential use up in the area, a lot of wintertime use that doesn't pertain to us. I guess to sum up, I would ask the board to approve as staff has presented the Eureka Gulch THP and waiver, and also the Four Waters waiver as well. I think those projects will continue on in the vein of what this board is trying to accomplish with monitoring and oversight on the timber harvest plan process. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Okay. Any questions from the board? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Van Lennep. Okay. Eric Moore?
Hello. I'm Eric Moore. I'm a neighbor of Steve Dousman's. He's been my closest neighbor for 12 years now. He's got to travel across my land to get to his. Nothing happens with equipment or anything going on his land that I don't have an intimate knowledge of, just because of the fact that it affects me, too. For years, I've seen nothing but beneficial things happening there. All his actions show a great love for his land. I've watched his mitigations, watched how they work. We share a road. We try to keep the road maintained as best we can. But I've got some things here that are a little harsher to say, but I think they kind of need to be said. Your staff did not participate in the PHI process. They abandoned a chance for meaningful input interacting with the other agencies in the NTMP. Your staff did go to Mr. Dousman's land in February and determined that he should be in the general waiver process. In July, Mr. Dousman appeared before your board to explain the process did not seem to be working. One of your board members even asked him, what can we do to help you? And he said, just process the application and the legal amount of time it's supposed to happen. Since then, he was reclassified to Tier 4. Nothing's changed since February, except he appeared before your board. This looks like retaliatory action. To punish him for speaking publicly. And furthermore, they then proposed that he trespass on the land of others as part of the process, which has now been dropped, which is good. But in summary, we have negligence, violation of statutory time limits, abuse of authority, mandating illegal activity. I don't know if your staff needs more supervision, but something's not right here. I think Mr. Dousman should be reclassified to the general waiver process, and you guys owe him an apology. And this is a lot to run somebody through. My comments here today are my own. I do serve on the board of directors of two landowner organizations. I contribute to the newsletters. Our members are all watching. They really want to know how this plays out. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any board questions? Okay. Kevin Collins.
Good morning. I went to the CDF office yesterday to look at the file on the NTMP. It would have been useful if that was available to you here, but they keep it. You've seen this photograph, but I took it with a camera yesterday just so that you would have some sense of the scale of the road problem that's part of the mitigation.
Okay, where, there's, Mr. Collins?
Yes, on
well,
the...
What's the photograph of?
It's a photograph of that section of road with the failure that was being discussed by the RPF just now. Okay. And that you saw images of.
Is it inside?
Yes, it's one of the haul roads for the NTMP.
Okay, but inside the harvest
yes.
area as opposed to
yes.
outside.
Okay. It's part of the harvest area. When I looked at the file at CDF, as a condition of this NTMP, they were required to monitor the site. I think Mines and Geology required that. And the principle was that they were going to use bioremediation. In other words, try to get vegetation to grow on this site in order to get root strength in there and stabilize the soil. The sequential photographs from, say, 2001, 2002, maybe 2004, 2005, and I think there were some from 2006, the ones I saw did not show any large woody plants growing on the site, and the written description from probably the RPF describing the attempts at bioremediation indicated that there had been failures of different species of plants to take hold on that slope. The photograph you were just shown gave you a small corner of that view, not the long view that you're seeing here on those images. So it's my opinion that the bioremediation is not successful, and that there are other ways of handling slides. There are engineering geology methods, such as trying to dewater the slide by driving what are essentially small wellhead pipes into the slope to try to get water out of the face of the slope. Anyway, I'm not an engineering geologist, but there are other methods besides bioremediation. I'm going to go ahead and read from Fish and Game's PHI comments just briefly.
Can I just clarify something? These photos,
yes.
These photos are 5 years old, right?
Yeah, that's 2002. It's
okay.
Marked on there.
Yeah.
But what I'm referring to is a sequence of photos. They continue to show straw being applied to the slope in 2005 and so on. So, and I didn't see any woody plants growing on the face in those photographs. And those are in the Felton office. If anybody would like to see them, I'm sure they could be made available to you. This is from Fish and Game's PHI, pre-harvest inspection comments. The unstable area, this is the same area that we're talking about at the moment, is also located near the confluence of two Class 1 water courses, this unnamed tributary, I think it's now been named, I forget the name we've given to it, and Newell Creek. The channel of the Class 1 water course is at the base of the slide, is significantly impacted by inputs of soil material. This actively eroding slide is a continuous source of sediment in Newell Creek. The letter from the City of Santa Cruz pointed out that this slide was a problem back in the 1980s. I don't think there's any reason to believe that bioremediation is likely to stabilize the face. At some point, when they start hauling, there, according to the NTMP document, there will be 4 to 6 truckloads over a 6 to 8 week period being run out of the plan area. I presume a substantial number of those truckloads will go over that road section. So there's going to be a lot of vibration, other impacts, even if the soil is not necessarily saturated at the time. So I think since there are engineering geology methods of dealing with that face, and it's been active for so long, and according to CDF, the toe of the slide is actively feeding into Newell Creek, that something besides attempting to plant some different forms of vegetation on this soil that's sloughing off the slope would be a good idea. Let me go on here quickly. I'll go ahead and jump to the Eureka Gulch plan. There's one other thing I wanted to point out about the Dousman NTMP. CDF attempts to provide access to all merchantable timber on the property. They don't say to a landowner, look, there's only a small amount of trees over here. Why don't you just abandon that section? They will find a way to cut a road over there. Whether that road is in compliance with the rules, and that's where in lieu practices come in. In other words, practices in lieu of the standard rule. In other words, roads that are in the WILPES or on slopes that are too steep. As for the Eureka Gulch, and by the way, there are 26 slides or unstable areas marked on the maps for the Dousman NTMP.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Are you referring to the slide that you're referring to? Is that also the location where the tarp has been applied over time? Do you have any comments on the effectiveness of that tarp?
Well, generally speaking, a tarp will keep rain impact and water sheeting from above from soaking into the slope. But it doesn't. It's a temporary situation, like holding an umbrella over yourself so you don't get wet. In other words, it's not going to create a permanent stabilization of the slope. It's strictly a temporal kind of thing when a big rainstorm comes in order to try to keep the slope from failing under the saturation from the rain.
But it's been applied over a series of years. They continue to use the tarp, so it must be having
well,
some effect.
Well, I guess they are. I can't speak to it because I don't know the history there. On the Eureka Gulch NTMP, THP, they discuss a road section that was taken out by a landslide, and somehow or another they're going to reconstruct this road and then deconstruct the road at the end of the plan, or abandon it, or I'm not sure, several terms have been used for how this road section can be dealt with. But the pretense that you can reconstruct a road across an active slide and then take it apart when you're done and not produce substantial amount of sediment discharge off of that, all those operations, is to me fantasy. There's going to be sediment discharge there, and it's only a question of how much. As far as, I'd like to make a couple of recommendations before my time runs out. At the beginning of this process, perhaps as much as 5 years ago, I made some comments as to other forms of monitoring besides turbidity. I understand that turbidity is the standard in the basin plan. However, there are other ways of dealing with unstable areas in particular, and those are erosion control pins. In other words, you drive a pin into an area, you see how much soil leaves or whether the pin falls out. You can also put up silt fences that it captures some of the sediment coming off the site, so you have some idea of how much erosion is leaving the site. It's much more specific than turbidity, and it's not as time sensitive because turbidity spikes and then goes down within hours, often before the monitoring might ever take place. I recommended a WDR because I'd like to see the regional board ask CDF for improvements or changes to the actual conduct of the plan if the board staff doesn't feel that the mitigation measures are functioning properly. That was the reason for that suggestion.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Any board questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jody Fratiani.
Thank you. Jody Fratiani representing Sierra Club. I'd like to say, first of all, that I have not seen the notice of operations submitted for this particular harvest. It's not in the file in the Felton office, so I'm assuming it hasn't been submitted yet. It's not clear from the plan. I'm talking about the Four Waters NTMP, which was drafted as one harvest unit, but it actually says in the plan that it's probable that only portions of this harvest will occur in any given at any given time. So they could do a portion of the harvest, this year or next year. They could come back in, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years to do the next part. But it's not clear what they actually intend to do. Secondly, I just wanted to say that this plan, that the Water Board did not participate in the review of this plan. I don't know why. It's unfortunate because I think it's very important to participate in all NTMPs, particularly in municipal water supply watersheds. But the City Water Department, the County, and the Department of Fish and Game all had very serious concerns about this plan and made recommendations against a number of actions and options that are still in there, such as cross-falling, such as winter operations. And the fact that they make make the recommendations, as you heard, doesn't mean they'll be accepted. The fact that there's a negotiation doesn't mean that they're happy with them. It means that they don't have the political will and their agency to actually non-concur, or then they don't feel that they'll actually get the changes that they want. So there are still things in here, cross-falling trees, and the plan actually says, even though they say today they're not going to do that, the plan says that they may fall up to 51 trees per harvest entry across the streams. That's what's called an in-lieu practice. It may be professional judgment, but basically it's considered outside of the realm of normal protection of water quality, and the alternative to having a tree that slides into the creek is not cutting it. Taking it and falling it across the stream and then dragging it out and perhaps destabilizing the banks. And I understand that some of the trees that were discussed at the PHI actually are the stream bank itself. Doesn't seem to me to be an option that's going to protect water quality. Some of the comments during the review of the plan, that slide, there was a geological report in 1988 on this particular slide that you've seen photographs of at this point in time, saying back then, the present condition of the section of the logging road appears to be detrimental to the stream environment. Sediment deposition in the stream due to erosion of the slide deposits could be significant during periods of heavy rainfall. Now, the California Geological Survey, in reviewing this plan, said that they expected at the end of 5 years that there would be 80 to 100% canopy cover on this slide of willows and conifers. What we saw was a picture of a very small area that was largely grass. And there's a, I'm sorry, I couldn't bring it or that your staff didn't present it, but the most recent photographs from 2007 in the CDF file show, in February of 2007, show a bunch of straw on top of the slide area, which says to me that even the grass that was there failed, but it does not have the kind of canopy cover that CGS was anticipating would take hold within a 5-year period. I think that a structural stabilization, which was suggested if bioremediation did not work, needs to actually take place to make sure this doesn't go into the creek. The picture of that illegal dirt bike crossing of the creek looks really bad, particularly when taken in the middle of the winter period. But the amount of sediment that can end up in a stream from 160-acre road segment failing, which we've heard happened on the Eureka plan, will deposit a whole lot more sediment into that water body than a dirt bike going back and forth a number of times in the winter. I guess I want to say, you know, the comments from the review team members, I wish you could see those, talk about increased sediment actually making it difficult for the city to determine what kind of other pollutants, what pathogens are in the water. It increases the disinfection byproducts. So they have severe concerns about this. Fish and Game is concerned because the suspended sediment, and you can have a nice catch basin, which is going to get the heavy solids, but if you've got sufficient flow, the suspended sediment is going to end up down in the creek. As we saw in the city's response, it's going to end up over the dam flowing into the San Lorenzo River, so not only impacting the city's water supply, but the downstream anadromous fish. And I would like to encourage your staff to allocate resources to Julia to have an engineer from your staff go out and review plans when you have this kind of difficult road feature you see on both of these plans, so that somebody who actually has the background and the education can help make an assessment. Don't rely on CGS. They don't have the same mandate to protect water that your agency does, and I think it's really important that you take that authority, utilize it to the best that you can to make sure that water quality is protected, particularly in these municipal water supply watersheds. And one last comment I wanted to make here, which has just flown my mind, is that it's gone. It's out here in the ether. So say if you have any questions, you can let me know. Maybe it'll come back. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Fradiani? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, last speaker, this last card is Joey Ricano.
3 minutes. Honorable board members, staff, friends, Joey Ricciano with the Ocean Outfall Group. As you know, my group is dedicated to ending waivers of the Clean Water Act, like the one that is sought here. I'm also the author of the Heritage Tree State Resolution. I am no stranger to forestry issues, particularly as pertains to water quality, to sedimentation from logging, anadromous fish, the effects. The WDR comes to mind. This would add to cumulative impacts in the area, and it would also have an effect. I concur with the Sierra Club's opinion. There's a time to start putting your foot down. Logging on unstable hillsides is not something that we should be turning a blind eye to. Just the timber harvest plans themselves are an issue. There was a study done not long ago by an activist. I can't remember his name now, but he's recently deceased. But he did a study that showed that because of funding shortcomings, that when CDF and Fish and Game have their timber harvest plan reviews, that the scientist went to the sites and found that the actual on-site conditions differed from the timber harvest plans 100% of the time. So I think what we need to do here is adhere to a watershed-wide waste discharge requirement point of view, realize that logging on unstable hillsides is a bad idea just at its face, the time to turn a blind eye to the conditions downstream from what we do upstream, particularly on a place that's being logged over and over again. I think it's time. That time is over, and I would respectfully request that you deny any waiver. That goes without saying. But also to make sure that the right oversight is done if any industrial activities are going to be done, particularly where unstable hillsides are involved. I thank you for this opportunity to address you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Any questions for Mr. Rocano? All right. Does any other member of the public wish to address the board on these two agenda items? Okay, so we'll close public comment.
I have a question for staff.
Go ahead.
About the report of waste discharge, which is cited in the order. Ms. Frediani was saying that there was nothing in the CDF file explaining exactly what the forester was going to do during this entry. Is that information in your file? Is it part of what you've reviewed?
Yeah, that's right. You've submitted that. Sorry, I have to defer to Bill on that. Because you're asking about the Four Waters Non-Industrial Timber Management Plan?
Well, I'm asking what you reviewed in preparing the waiver in terms of knowing what the activities were going to be that are subject to this waiver.
I definitely reviewed the Non-Industrial Timber Management Plan. Have you submitted the...
Yeah, no, the waiver covers the entire plant area, and that's what was reviewed during our site visit with staff. And that allows some flexibility as to what area within the harvest, within the entire operating plan, is entered. But the notice of timber operations isn't a different document. It just highlights the functional components of the area that you're operating in. So it would naturally include, what you would, if it was smaller, you would still get the whole monitoring and reporting program applied. If it was the entire area, then that's what this is fit for.
Have you submitted the notice of timber?
We have not submitted the NTO. This process has been long enough that we're not even going to be able to harvest till next year. So the NTO is only good for 1 year. So we would have been pointless to file it because we would have not been able to operate this year anyway.
So, yes, I've reviewed the non-industrial timber management plan, but not the NTO.
And there's no additional information in the report of waste discharge about this particular entry other than what's in the NTMP?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Well, public comment is closed. Board deliberation.
Can we take it one at a time?
Yeah, we should take the first one, Four Waters, first. Dr. Press.
This is, I guess, a question for staff. So according to your staff report, you were satisfied that that slide area was properly stabilized.
Yes.
What do you think about the comment that there could be more woody plants growing on that that slope by now? I mean, what does it say about the nature of the stabilization if there aren't any yet?
Well, I was thinking about that since they made the comment, and I don't see what the woody debris might buy you as far as stabilization, because when I saw that site in February during a rain event, I was comfortable with the condition of the slope at that time. So, yeah, I don't specifically about woody debris, I don't think I'm comfortable to say that I feel like it would buy us some additional protection or not.
Did the slope seem saturated to you?
It was definitely saturated soil conditions, and it's covered completely with grass at this time, with some minor exceptions. Bill was just explaining to me that tarp that Monica was asking about is slowly being phased away as the vegetation takes hold. So I feel like I saw the site during the most vulnerable time of year for it to be moving. Mm-hmm. And I'm comfortable with the condition and the level of attention that it's receiving from the landowner.
Dr. Hunter?
There was also a comment about the possibility of regional board staff engineer mm-hmm. inspecting roads that present these kinds of unstable situations. I'm not clear. Has that occurred at all in this situation, or is that something that we can apply in terms of monitoring and follow-up observations?
It has not occurred in the situation, but yes, I think that would be an excellent idea for if I could have permission to bring with me an engineering geologist from the office on my winter inspections, my post-harvest inspections, and no doubtly on these I'd like to be out there for active harvest. So I think that's an excellent suggestion by Jody Frediani.
Is that something, Mr. Briggs, that can be accomplished resource-wise?
Well, we do have engineering geologists on staff, and it would be a matter of how we allocate the time that's available for timber, because they would charge to the allocation that we have in the budget for timber.
So, in other words, it would use up part of the three-quarter PY.
Yeah, but if it's, you know, it's a matter of prioritizing that, and if that's, well, it's actually 0.6, but if we saw that as a priority, then it would make sense to do that. Mm-hmm. So, I think we can, and it sounds like this is about the most critical situation, so I think that would make sense.
I have had that discussion with engineering geologists on staff. They've either approached me or I've approached them about these conditions, and it is exactly what you discussed. Their supervisors say we need a charge code to allow them to go out and take a look.
Well, I think we would be supportive of that. Mm-hmm. Dr. Press?
Well, this does, of course, raise the same set of general concerns that were raised at the July meeting. The review process does have to get has to be speedier. We made that comment back in the July meeting, making it again here, and I think that Mr. Briggs, we're looking for some kind of analysis and response by the board staff to tell us what the bottlenecks are. I mean, it may be the case that there simply just isn't enough of Julia to go around for this particular her set of tasks, but I don't think that this is a sustainable situation, a sustainable level of response. So can we think of some way to make her work more efficient, assist her in some other way? I don't know. What can we do?
Well, two responses. First of all, I'll remind the board that I emailed to you basically early version of the staff prepared a status of the waivers. It was response to the comments we had at the previous, maybe it was two meetings ago. But anyway, status of the waivers that we received, I guess, in the last year and how we've processed those, what the process times were. And we're up to date on all the waivers that we received, aside from the ones that fell into Tier 4, which you're seeing before you today, and then there's one more Tier 4 where the application is incomplete, I believe.
That's correct. I received an updated application yesterday for that plan.
Okay. So, and the second part is, I think there was a process failure where we could have improved by not recognizing that these plans fell into Tier 4. So my suggestion there, and we're following up on that, is to have the plans reviewed through the matrix right off the bat. And we can have a student do that so that we know as soon as we receive them which route they're going to take. And I think the problem here is that we didn't realize these were going to be Tier 4. And then we ran into the extensive lead time that we have for a board meeting. So we've made a change in the process to try to make sure that we don't have as much of a time delay for the Tier 4s. And I think for the other ones, the Tiers 1, 2, and 3s, again, I'll remind you that I sent that status report to you, and I think it's pretty acceptable as far as the processing times. They're not excessive, I don't think.
Go ahead, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. On a different topic, the issue of cross-filling and the kind of impact that might occur once the log is removed from the stream. And is it different for Class 1? Are the impacts different for Class 1 streams or considered to be different for Class 1 versus Class 2 and 3? And is there typically some kind of bank impacts that occur when the log is actually removed?
Well, Bill can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure that cross-filling is not allowed on Class 1 or 2 streams. It's only allowed on Class 3s. And in the post-harvest inspections I've conducted, I've never seen an instance where there was some type of unstable bank or residual problems because of cross-falling.
Partially true. You can cross twos, but as I pointed out for this particular waiver, and it's going to be different every time, but there weren't any cross-felled trees at all. And the only time that you apply that particular method is if it's going to be more damaging if you just throw it up the hill and expect it maybe to kick back. It's really a very specific tool that we might use in very limited instances, despite what the plan says about our ability. That's kind of some standard language that really wasn't applied for this particular notice because the marking's been done. Well, we haven't submitted the notice yet, but the marking's been complete.
Yeah, so is there a different method or a different technique than for when you actually extract that log where it's placed?
It never comes in contact with the water. The intent is not to fall it into the creek. It's to actually span it. And more often than not, that's in cable yarding settings where you're actually plucking the logs out. And it's just that the tree would land. And it's very specific. Again, and you're looking at the ground and making almost engineering level judgment calls as to what the most effective and least damaging alternative is.
So in the annual report that's issued, do those appear as a metric? Do you give?
I think, no, the annual report's more general, but I think you would capture any potential problems associated with it in the overall review of the water course and near stream areas. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think, that goes with, I think, the entire analysis, that being a part of it, and in this particular case, not being a part of it because we're not applying it. But, mm-hmm. you would see that as again, part of the overview.
Okay, thank you.
If this is something the board's concerned about, since the discharger's representing that they're not going to use this technique, you can add language to the order specifically prohibiting cross-falling.
Well, what would you think about that, Mr. Vaughn?
The only reason I would question that is now we're getting into reinterpreting the forest practice rules and the reviewed and approved plan, and I mean once we get on that slope, it's a little slippery, because now we're saying, well, we don't like the marking percentage, or we don't like this, or we don't like that, so we're going to start changing the approved plan, sort of, and I don't know if that's within the scope of the waiver process. I don't know. That's a question. It's a,
I think it is.
I think so, too.
So that aside, on the merits of that particular,
yeah, and we haven't, yeah, I haven't, I wouldn't have a problem with it because we didn't mark any cross felled trees, but
right.
I think, and that's legal counsel's job is to interpret at what point the water board's authority to reinterpret approved plans in terms of the functional operating components is beyond the scope of the waiver, given it's a near stream, it's a near stream practice, that may be something that's within the scope. So that
this is the sort of thing where making it explicit is. I mean, you talk about a negotiation that the different agencies make when they are in the pre-harvest process, and you're already saying you're not going to do it, and so if this is a way to increase sort of confidence in all the stakeholders, you know, it's a worthwhile thing.
Yeah, no, I think it's reasonable. I think what I would make sure happens is that we don't usurp that ability for the entire plan or for in the future, where we might actually, I might come with to you with a waiver that says I've got three felled cross-felled trees that I'd like to have you approve. Now, that would probably require specific review with staff, and maybe point that out as part of our site inspection. That might be something that we can develop in the future. Again, we're running on a kind of a slope, and this is one specific operational practice. But where do we stop that?
Well, you know, about the slippery slope aspect, I'm not worried that we're in any danger of starting to get into micromanaging which trees you're going to fall, in which direction you're going to fall, where you're going to put the cable and all that. I really don't think that's going to happen. We're only seeing you when you come up with Tier 4 plans anyway. I can almost guarantee you that we're not about to do that. We just don't have the wherewithal.
And
we also went into that eligibility set of tiers precisely so that we didn't have you before us for every single timber harvest plan.
And the only other comment I would have is that perhaps the board members and or staff could see specific examples of where it is applied and the reasons for its application. It's really designed as a mitigation measure to avoid impacts, not as a practice that allows you to somehow maximize trees.
And that's the sort of thing where if you had a some photos that would show a particular situation and demonstrate that you basically have three options. You could not take the tree. You could take the tree up slope. You could cross fell the tree and show what those that would I think make it more clear what's going on,
right.
And why they're we should leave that.
Agreed. Yeah, I think that's and unfortunately our appearance here is pretty disjointed, and in terms of the understanding.
And it doesn't happen very much anymore, which
right.
is good. So that's great. But I would recommend it just for the sake of increasing the confidence in the plan that we put that in there. And
given that it's specific to this waiver.
Given that it's specific to this waiver, and given that you're not planning on doing it anyway. So
right.
Why not?
Okay. Any other board comments or questions with this? Mr. Hodgson?
I guess the concern that comes up in my mind is that I don't think the board wants to be in a position of trying to dictate what the professionals are doing that are on site and can actually see the particular situation. So we know things happen, and they happen quickly. They need to address the issue there. And so I hate to see us tying their hands and taking away a potential tool if we don't absolutely have to.
So you would not be in favor of?
I would not be in favor of
Dr. Press's
comment.
Okay. All right.
Dr. Bowker.
On the same note, if I understand what the forester was saying, that cross-felling only occurs when an uphill fall has a potential of creating more of a problem. Given that that's so, you want to be careful that you don't mandate something that's going to cause more damage than not mandating it. I mean, I'd rather leave that kind of in the hands of the professional unless we can be shown that it really does cause more damage. Of course, the alternative is not to cut the tree, but that's...
Right. That would be my comment, is that the decision then to not take the tree if there were potential impacts to the stream. And we're talking about one tree at a time here, consideration apparently.
Do we have that authority, Ms. Okun, to prevent a tree from being cut?
Yes, you have the authority to impose any requirements that are necessary to adequately protect water quality.
Well, what Dr. Bowker is saying is, I mean, you could interpret it several ways. You could say that if you have a restriction that's preventing cross-felling, and the professional forester looks at a tree that would have been that might pose a risk if it's felled upslope on the slope, that then because they can't use the cross-falling option, they might just not take that tree, which would possibly be more protective of water quality. I don't know. It could go either way. But since in this instance and this particular waiver, they said the forester said that he wasn't going to use it. I don't see why it's all that problematic. But I'll defer to my colleagues. I have one more comment, if I may.
Go ahead.
Or one more question for staff. We heard Mr. Collins talk about alternatives to turbidity measures. Turbidity monitoring is this perennial problem. Everybody hates it, but everybody puts up with it. Nobody likes it, and yet we do it anyway. We can't put a $50,000 continuous monitoring machine in every creek, and obviously, even though that would, of course, give us the best. So what do you think about erosion pins and silt fences as non-water column turbidity measures, and should we be exploring those as very site-specific ways of capturing what's going on? What's your sense of that?
Well, I'm not familiar with those treatments, and I think that it is those ideas definitely merit further investigation by staff. I definitely will be looking into that, and can come back to you with a more specific proposal.
Right, because I could imagine, heaven forbid that we don't do water column turbidity measures that are meaningless, but I can imagine a suite of turbidity measures that were site-specific, where you're actually measuring the movement of soil in the near vicinity of a water crossing, and if it was a meaningful way that had a track record, I'm open to trying something like that.
I agree.
Let's try to move off of this bad, meaningless measure if it's not working. Why impose the time and cost for a measure that doesn't work? I'm not wedded to it. So if you could come back to us looking at that, it might simplify life a lot and make more meaningful, too.
Absolutely, I will.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Further board comments, questions? I'll entertain a motion. Well, Mr. Shawcross?
I was just going to say, if the folks aren't going to do the cross-felling anyway, and so we're going to put it in that they can't do it, I mean, it's sort of a difference without any meaning. So then what do we do the next time it comes before us and someone wants to cross fell? I don't have a problem with putting it in or leaving it out, basically, because it only has meaning to folks who it makes feel better about the, and I guess that has some value. But
I feel the same way. I don't want to get into micromanaging a site. In this context, I don't see any harm in doing it, since the applicant doesn't seem to care if it's in there. But it is a mitigation measure, and I think that's kind of strange that we might proscribe that. And I wouldn't want anything we do today with this particular permit to be construed as precedence that we would do it again in the future.
Okay, I'll withdraw it.
All of these have to be looked at individually and weighed separately.
That's fine.
And it may be in the future, it might be appropriate in some situation, but, you know.
Okay, I'll withdraw it, and I'll move that we...
But I would vote for it if it was... I'm not... Don't take my comments as saying it doesn't belong in there. Uh-huh. I'm saying I don't care for this because the applicant doesn't care.
Right.
I just want to make sure that in the future, because things that we say here seem to have a tendency to come back and bite us in different ways. And so I just want to make sure that that is clear, that, you know, we'll look at everything new in the future.
Mr. Chair, let me ask staff.
Mr. Jeffries.
On the same subject, Julia, when there are trees that are noted to be fell across a stream on this particular classification, is the staff notified? Are you looking at those particular waterways to see if there would be any discharge?
Yes, when they propose cross-filing, they mention it in the plan, and then that's something that I asked to see when I'm on the inspection.
And these trees are marked so you will know which ones they are? Do the forester go? Does he go with you?
Yeah, the forester explains where they're proposing to do that.
Okay.
Well, one last question. What options do you have if you see a situation that you feel is inappropriate or could cause more impacts than can be mitigated for? What options do you have in your review?
Well, that's prior to the plan being approved by CDF, so I can recommend as an agent review team member that cross-falling not be allowed in that area. And if I feel strongly enough about it, I can non-concur on the plan and say you shouldn't approve this plan if you're going to allow that. And then if they approve it anyway, I can, even if it ranks as Tier 1 in the process, I can elevate it to Tier 4 and add a condition that they're not allowed to be cross-falling. So
we have the opportunity to look at it here again.
Yeah, there's a lot of backstops in the process, so I'm pretty comfortable with not putting a restriction on cross-falling, only because even though Bill says that they're not going to be cross-falling, they might encounter a situation for
unforeseen
circumstances where it's the best way to protect water quality. So I agree with the statements about not wanting to tie hands behind their back because we don't have a specific location that we're worried about.
If that was the case, would the forester notify you, and would you look at that before they removed that tree?
No, they would not notify me, but they would notify me if through forensic monitoring. If one of the triggers for forensic monitoring is if a management practice fails, they need to call within 24 hours, take photos, turbidity monitoring, the whole bit. So if it goes awry and somehow impacts water quality, I'd get a phone call in that case.
Oh, okay.
Well, were there no trees marked for cross-felling in this particular plan?
I don't remember there being any trees marked for cross-felling on this plan.
Let's assume no trees were marked for cross-felling. Does that mean that none can therefore be cross-felled? Because you wouldn't have had an opportunity to take a look at them.
I'm going to let Bill answer that question. I'm thinking, well, go ahead, Bill.
Again, it's... You wouldn't take a non-cross-felled tree and cross-fall it. And part of this is fairly moot with the channel tree interpretation of the T&I rules, where usually it's close so that if it kicked up the hill and back down, that's what you're really trying to avoid, is a stump kicking and coming back down, versus a fairly, you know, no two slopes are the same. So maybe this side's steeper and this side's gentler, where you're close enough to the water course where it just hits like that, spans the water course, and you're able to pull it out. So, again, you wouldn't... you wouldn't throw it over there just to throw it across the creek. You know, it'd be a very specific example, and more often it would be very obvious that it's going to be more damaging if you do throw it across.
Of course, you'd run out in front of it if it does.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's try to wrap this up if there's no more questions or comments.
All right. Well, I'll move that we accept the staff's recommendation.
Second the motion.
Okay. Any last comments by the board? Okay. All those, this is agenda item number 14, yes. Four Waters.
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion carries unanimously. We have the agenda item 15 plan. That's Eureka Gulch.
Move this item as well, unless there's any other.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, we have a first and a second. Any last board comments on this one? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, this carries unanimously. Thank you very much. What we will do, of course, is break for lunch, and looks like we will now be back at 1:30, right, Mr. Briggs, instead of 1. And then we may go to public comment.
Your choice.
Yeah, we may go to public comment then before we. Okay. All right, then I guess we will then have to, because we may, the lawyer that is advising the board on the Los Osos and county status report, we only have till 5 o'clock. This would be for agenda item 23. So
should
then
be fine.
Pardon me?
Should be fine.
Yeah. I mean, if we do public comment even before then?
Well, I mean, we're not supposed to start that till 1:30 anyway.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, if we want to do public comment first, general public comment. So we'll do agenda item 23 when we come back at 1:30. Okay? And then we'll do general public comment after that.
Thank you.